financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rayum.
Hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rayum.
Hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rayum. Hi.
Hey, Jess, how are you?
I am good, and we have a guest, which I always love when you bring someone on.
We do. We have Jocelyn King with us, backed by popular demand. She's from Smarter Online Safety, and boy, I just loved having her. She's so full of information and the kind of information that we need right now about keeping our accounts safe online and just living a little safer, considering the fact that everybody knows how to click a link these days, including the criminals. So yeah. Welcome, Jocelyn.
Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to be here.
Our pleasure. So, she's been clandestined in the side room with the headphones on while we decided what we're going to ask her about on our little cybersecurity game show here. Truly, she has no idea what these questions will be, but she's a good egg and always will, come on and talk to us about this. So, I would like to get a little background because, it is true that people, even people who listen to podcasts a lot, may not really understand online safety. People think, well, as long as I don't click the link in my email, I'm okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So can you give us a foundation of maybe some of the top things that people don't understand that they should be aware of in terms of protecting their bank accounts or their personal information online?
Absolutely. The world of hackers and cybercrime is continually evolving, and they're getting smarter about online crime, and that's why we named the company Smarter Online Safety, because we all need to get smarter about our safety. And we're online and offline, but of course we're focusing on the cybersecurity world. And what really happens is most people think, okay, as long as I'm, well, actually there's a lot of people who still are clicking links in SMS texts that are suspicious and phishing emails. I will say over 80% of attacks come from clicking on links. And it sounds fairly obvious, like, oh, there's a link, I shouldn't click on it. But if you're getting an email or a text from who you think is your boss's boss or your uncle or your child or something, and it has an urgent message in it, I think the foundational thing to know about cyber criminals is they rely on getting you into a fear state. When you get into fight or flight, you lose your ability to think with your prefrontal cortex, which is our higher human brain that helps us make smart decisions. And they can get us out of that in a second by making us feel that our teenager's in trouble or our mother, who's maybe starting to show early onset, signs of Alzheimer's or something, is saying something's going on and we have to help. And that getting that bias for action that we have to do the right thing is what hackers rely on to manipulate us into taking the wrong action that will benefit them. So just think that it's number one, whether it's a link or a phone call or anything, if you, first of all, trust your gut, first of all. Rarely do I talk to somebody who had zero spidey sense or gut feel that something might be wrong. So if you think that at all, take a beat. The other thing is, we have a saying in cybersecurity called zero trust. Okay, so zero trust means you assume you can't trust anyone and you verify everything. And by doing that, you won't accidentally click on something that is seemingly innocuous, because they are getting better and better. It's more likely you're going to get an email you think is suspicious, you know, almost from a friend than from a hacker, because hackers, really good ones, have gotten so good at imitating your real friends. They've downloaded everything about you on your Facebook account and your friend's account. So they're talking to you, and they're using AI tools to mimic the language. You know, yeah. Everybody who's learning about AI, you learn that you can mimic anyone's voice and cadence, and you can mimic their language choices and mm-hmm. things. So you can ask an AI to put things in Francis's, you know, how would Francis say this? And then text it to Jess, and it's yeah. going to sound like Francis. And that's the day and age we're living in. Okay. So I think, first of all, you have to, I don't say trust but verify. I say be suspicious and verify.
Yeah, it's gone way beyond. Spoofing. I'm sorry, yeah. Just go ahead.
It's okay. I just was going to say, I think also in addition to the panic text you get, something has happened, like you've got to bail somebody out or whatever, where you right. click on it. We're also busy in our regular lives, and we're now available 24/7 to bosses and everyone else, which is a problem. So mm-hmm. if you're doing other things, you're getting dinner ready for the kids, you're, you know, finishing up work stuff, and you get an email in, chances are you can click it, not because you're not being smart, but because you're busy and right. there's a million things going on.
Right, right. And you're exactly right. And what then, they rely on the busyness. The other thing is, a lot of damage being done to your accounts and stuff is happening while you're not online, while you're working, while you're shopping, while you're at the gym, while you're sleeping, because, you know, I've had some people in my classes who, when they learn, you have to learn how vulnerable you are in order to learn how to protect those vulnerabilities. And in that moment where people realize how vulnerable they actually are, while we're starting to protect them, is when they think, I just want to throw my computer and phone and never get online again. And I say, but that's the worst thing you could do, because all of your, even if you never got online again, it's not just you have to worry about. It's the fact that your social security number, your logins, your password, your information, even if you never opened an account and had a password, it's in all these financial institutions, government agencies that are hacked on a daily basis. And then it's your information sold on the dark web. So the most, I tell people, stop trying to protect your social security number. And I don't mean put it on a billboard or put it on your Facebook, home screen. Right. But what I mean is stop trying to protect it and focus on how do I make sure it's not being used against me. And that's mm-hmm. where you want to make sure you are, for instance, freezing your credit, turning on two-factor authentication. So let's say you're at work and you get an alert that something's going on your account. You could have had, somebody social engineer, a customer service rep at a company. You get, your mobile phone company phone number and login. But from that, they can get information about you that they can then use to hack into your financial accounts or retirement account. And if you suddenly get an alert that one of your financial accounts is being logged into, you know you're being hacked real time, and you need to, take action. If you didn't turn on your authentication, if you didn't have your credit frozen, these things would be happening while you're going about your business or sleeping or on or sitting by the pool, and you find out about, some people find out about it months and even over a year later, and that's when you have irreversible damage.
Yeah, but let's point out, taking action does not mean clicking that link, because you Correct. Will get things that say your account is being hacked. You need to do this immediately. You're getting a delivery and we can't deliver it. Please give us your address. I mean, there's a million of these things that come through. Mm-hmm. So at the very most basic core, what I tell people is whatever source you think it came from, you don't touch the message. You call the source on the phone, you call your local bank, or you call your local payment company or whoever is sending that to you and say, I got this, I'm suspicious of it. Is there really something going on with my account?
Correct. Right. And by the way, I've talked to people who have done that, but they've inadvertently, because again, they're in a fight or flight in mind, they're calling the phone number that the hacker sent them in the text or email.
Exactly.
Saying, please call us at Bank of X. And then they give the 800 number, number, but that 800 number is a set up call center by the hackers too. And so you're sort of doing the right thing, but you're getting it from the wrong source. So exactly, completely exit the phone conversation, the email, or the SMS text, and then go to the known good source. So not everybody's going to have, like, if you bank with Bank of America or Chase or whomever, you may not have their phone number already in your phone. So first of all, that's a great thing to do. You got nothing, you know, you're sitting in the doctor or dentist office.
Make sure.
A good time. Add it to your contacts. And then you have the correct one, and then you can call them. But go to the website, and also always go to their actual website and get it. Hackers have also been taking over a lot of sponsored links on Google. So you could get into a hacked site, hasn't been caught yet and taken down, because you're clicking on that sponsored link at the top of Google, Google results.
Yep.
Go to the bank, BOFA.com or Chase.com.
Right.
Go do the right one and then only get the phone number from there.
Yeah, watch
those
addresses
first. Can you ever just ignore it? Like, for example, I keep getting the easy toll one, and everyone's getting them now, where you owe, you know, however much in toll.
Yeah, then you can also block and report. That does help in the background, because when all of us are doing that, it focuses law enforcement and the large companies' attention on those as suspicious, and that's how hackers get taken down faster, or their site.
Yeah.
Block.
I hit the delete and report junk all the time, but I still get them.
Me
so
too.
Can I ignore it? Can I just ignore it?
You can. And I would recommend, if you're going to ignore it, I'd recommend you also delete it so you don't accidentally.
Yeah.
Just like purse dialing, aka butt dialing, and things like that can happen. You never want to accidentally engage. I would recommend you just delete it.
Okay.
Either delete or delete and report. I take pictures of them because then I use them in my trainings.
Perfect. We could add to your collection, I bet.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I've had a lot of people send me things and say, "Here, can you tell me about this?" And then I say, "Yes, and may I use this? I'm going to use this." And I take out any personal information, obviously, but yeah.
Can we get some contact information for you, Jocelyn, before we go to break?
Sure. So anybody who wants to learn more about how to be safer online can come to smarteronlinesafety.com, and we've got newsletters and videos and a lot of free stuff and some classes and workshops that you can learn from and protect yourself.
Yeah, I can't wait for our second half to talk more with you about this sort of thing. And I'm sure Jess has questions too. But one of the things that occurs to me is what's going on in the political environment. And when we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit about people's bank accounts and how we might protect things like that.
All right, let's get your phone number, Frances.
Sure, it's 413-773-3333.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram, on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram, and we have a special guest today talking about keeping ourselves safe online.
We do. Welcome back to Jocelyn King from Smarter Online Safety. And, she's just got so much information. I'm sure if she's willing, we'll have her back again. The reason I wanted to talk about this is because people say those things to me. They say, "I won't do online banking because I want to be safe." And I'm saying, look, the horses left the corral years ago. We used to have our social security numbers on our driver's licenses.
Yeah.
on the driver's license that you handed to everybody. And it's still the same situation. The more information that is out there, the more at risk you are. And you do classes about this that people can sign up for. So can you talk a little bit about, what those classes are like and how easily accessible they are to people so that they could learn? They could learn.
Sure. So I have a masterclass that just gives the basics in a 2-hour. And in fact, Frances, I'll give you a code so that I'll give you a code that makes it like a $7 class instead of a $97 class for your listeners. And because I'm really wanting people to get safer online. So we'll get you that. But then I also have a half day workshop called, Safer Now. And you can come in, and that's the hands-on. Because what I recognize is a lot of people, like, for instance, everybody knows they should have complex, you know, passwords,
yeah, passwords.
And 8 passwords for each one. Yeah. That's great. But then they're like, okay, but how do I do it? Or I keep forgetting it. And most people spend most of their time resetting their password every time they're trying to log in. And then they don't do it. And I understand why. So what I do is I help you actually not just tell you that you should use a password manager, but we actually, it's a workshop. You're sitting there, we're getting it set up, we're putting your most important accounts in, you're generating a new password, we're making sure you're using a new email or an email that's kind of pristine that you don't use for all your junk email newsletters and coupons and all that, so that you are getting safer and your information is not vulnerable. So it's literally a hands-on where you walk through that. We talk about freezing your credit. So some people come in with that done. Other people need to know how to do it. Got a little setup for that. We walk through just the 7 things that everybody has to do. So you leave after a half day actually safer and not with a list of things to go do on your own. Because most of us, and I found this too, I mean, I got into cybersecurity because I was targeted by cyber criminals and hacked and lost a ton of money and had my life implode. And when you're in the middle of it or looking at, you know, yeah, I should protect myself. It's like, you should write a trust and a will and you should do this. And we just keep kicking that can down the road forever. So come in, spend 4 hours and you get it all done. And you have that sense of relax. I guarantee you, some people write and they say, oh my gosh, I had the best night's sleep after that because those things that are weighing on you are, you know, we've taken care of most of them. And most cybercrime is very formulaic. That's what I do. You know, part of my trainings is I have what I call taking the hoodie off the hacker, where I just teach you the basics of how cyber criminals and hackers work. Because, you know, there are special cases where if you're under personal attack, they will go to great efforts, you know, technologically and personally, and invest a lot of time in nuance trying to social engineer you. But the average person isn't going to experience that. The average person is experiencing what's called a brute force attack, which is just thousands of possible combinations of email logins and passwords and stuff until, you know, until they get lucky, just like, you know, in Vegas, you know, and so most people are under the threat of that. So it's very easy to set things up so that you have incredibly low odds of getting attacked under those conditions. But yeah, ransomware is a real deal. And Lockbit, you know, it's not the first, it won't be the last. This it's been getting more and more commercialized. And let me just tell your audience, this is the reason why cybercrime is not going away. For $45, you can get malware and a mentor. Yeah. And they have internships in cybercrime. And so you're getting a mentor. And a criminal just needs a smart device and an internet connection, and they can make $25,000 a month. For $4.99 a month, you can get the AI tool that emulates somebody's voice. That is where Jess could get a call where it sounds like Francis talking to you, and they're typing in what it should, but actually the AI is even telling us, this is Francis would use this word, not that word. A quick story, if you'd like, on how this is happening.
Yeah, because so you're creeping me out here.
This is a bit of a fan. Well, this is the reality of what you have to be aware of. This is why I say approach with zero trust. And regardless of whether you should be paying attention to this country or not that country or this organization or not that, just you're never going to know what's coming at you. So just be suspicious. Assume a certain percentage of outreach to you on the phone, in text and emails is going to be hacking. And then you're looking for it. It's a lot easier to start seeing things when you're looking, going, oh, is this one of those that I'm expecting? Than it is to just be caught off guard. So the CFO of Ferrari got a phone call from the CEO of Ferrari, who they work with on a daily basis and have for years, saying, I'm with this company. We want to close this deal. I negotiated down to a great price, but we've got to act now. I need you to wire this money to there. Now, what the CEO was asking the CFO was not a completely uncommon thing. They do deals all the time. Except the CFO had never heard of this deal before. And every other time this has happened, they've known about the deal. So the CFO was super smart, and this is where we want to get smarter and do things like this. It said, I'd be happy to. Yesterday I was in your office and you recommended a book to me. What was the title that book?
That's right.
Yeah. And they hung up because what it was, but if you can imagine, the CFO of Ferrari believed it was the voice of the CEO. That's how good the AI voice tools are. So you can imagine getting a call from your uncle or aunt that you haven't talked to in however many months and it sounding just like them. So if you know that this could be happening, you get over the surprise part of the attack, so you attack.
And you're on guard. Yeah, I'd like to take a moment to say that our company doesn't make any outbound sales calls at all. If you call us, we talk to you. But if you ever get a call that sounds like it's from me, I want you to follow the same guideline we just talked about. Hang up, call me back on my real line and tell me, you know, hey, I just got a call from you. Because it's a very simple thing. It's like, don't click the link, right? It's a simple thing, but you have to internalize it and do it over and over and over again. That is really creepy. But what you just said, I do also, and Jess probably does too. You get all these things from Facebook or LinkedIn or other places where they say, so-and-so is trying to connect with you. And hey, how you doing? Haven't seen you in a long time. And I do that. I say, if this is real, I don't mean to be offensive. And I say that. I don't mean to be offensive, but I haven't heard from you in years. And if this is really you, you'll be able to tell me how we met, or you'll be able to tell me what our connection is or whatever. And they never even respond. It's always some hacker, you know?
Right.
And is this a way of the future, or is there a solution for this? Because this just seems like, honestly, for the average person, just a giant pain. Like every call you get, you gotta worry that it's going to be AI. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and you're not, that's the other thing too, because when I was actually under attack for a long haul cyber crime thing, I was living living on an adrenaline and cortisol drip for 2 years, and then it destroyed my health. So I don't recommend you be on that kind of alert. I mean, unless you actually are a soldier, you don't want to be living like you're a soldier in a war zone. But you just need to be alert. You know, it's kind of like the way we teach our kids about safety if they're walking to, you know, three doors down to their friend's house or whatever. You know, you teach them, don't take candy from strangers, don't get in the car. You know, this is what you do if somebody, you know, tries to, you scream and you run or whatever. You know, there's all those things we were taught as kids and we teach our kids. Well, there's an online version of that. And in fact, that's the biggest thing that I solve. I think one thing that Smart Online Safety is doing is we help you see your online world like the same way you see your device. So see your devices as your doors of your online house. See your you see your accounts and your password as the windows. And see your Wi-Fi router as your garage door. This is what we teach in the workshop. So you're literally having this online house model and you're writing down your account, because once you see something, you can protect it. It's the fact that everything's online and in cyberspace and therefore seemingly invisible that you can't protect what you can't see. But the hackers, that's where they live, so they can come at you. So they have an unfair advantage until you start seeing your online house and protecting it the same way you lock up your physical house when you leave.
I remember years ago, one of the people that helped us with security with our website, and so one of the things we do is we don't ask for account numbers or social security numbers. I don't want that stuff in our system, even though everything's encrypted. But I just figured it's safer if we don't need it to not ask for it online, right? Mm-hmm. But I remember this time when I got a call from him. Now, he was a government security specialist in Europe. And in a 24-hour period, he saw something like 385 attempts to get to our site from different servers. But he caught it immediately because he had handwritten a script to do that, to catch that. You know, we were down for less than 24 hours and back up again. But that had to be 15 years ago. I was always grateful to him for catching that. And I also thought, well, what could they have gotten? Not very much. We still have that model today where we don't ask for those things. I wish that more places did that. You know,
The interesting thing about that, and I just did an episode on this on my Smarter Online Safety podcast too, where I had an expert on and we were digging into it. But the point is that the reason people ask for your, why do you need to give your veterinarian your social security number? What does that possibly have to do? But it goes back to these are really archaic models. I used to build databases back in the day. And the unique identifier for people back in the day was a social security number. So they would ask for it so that you had a unique record guaranteed because nobody else would have your social security number. But some of those, it's like, you know, they're still being used, even though most of them have a way to give you a unique customer ID. So what I've done, and I've been doing this for years, you know, on that form where you fill out and you're supposed to hand print your your social security number. And when you're sitting in a doctor's office or something, I just leave it blank.
Yeah.
And I I'll wait for them to ask me, and they never ask me for
they
it.
They never do.
So,
exactly.
So you're just giving it away. And here's the other thing, never write anything. When I'll tell you, I was signing up with a new mobile carrier for my cell phone. And over the phone, they're asking me for my social security number. And I can hear all the, I know they're in a call center offshore.
Yeah.
And I said, well, no, I don't give that out. And I suddenly got suspicious. And I said, I need to call you back. What is my ticket number? And I'm going to call, I need to call you back. I didn't say why. I didn't say, I don't trust you or whatever. But I thought, oh my God, this might be a voice phishing call.
Right.
So I hung up and I called back into the main line, got through, gave my ticket number. And it was actually this large mobile carrier asking me for my phone number. Now, anybody on an overseas, you know, call center can be sitting there with a pad and pen and writing all these social security numbers down and walking out and make more money selling those later on the dark web than they did in their whole day of work at the mobile carrier. So that's what I don't like about it. I actually sent an email to the head of online security at that company talking about my background in cyber and that they need to change this. And we're actually talking, I'm actually going to be helping to train some of their employees now because this is prevalent. But don't give out your social security number unless it's a government agency or a financial institution. You have to, and then do it knowing that it's being captured in a secure way where other eyes can't see it.
Yeah, always great information from you, Jess. Do you have any further questions for Jocelyn?
I mean, I have a million questions, but we're out of time. So
we are.
It's just really interesting. And it's, you just do have to be hyper aware. And it's hard because we're doing so many other things to have to focus on this. But the other option is going through like what you went through, which was 2 years of your life that were ruined because of this. So,
and half a million dollars. Yeah.
Yeah. $1 million.
Yes.
Let me get a phone number if people want to give you a call to find out more or to maybe take one of the online classes.
So actually, we're changing our, we've had some issues with security with phone services that we've been looking at. So I want people to come to smarteronlinesafety.com and engage with us there. And you can sign up for the classes. I'll get later today, I will get you that code, Francis, so you can share that with your listeners. And
that would be great.
Everybody just stay suspicious, protect yourself. Mm-hmm. And just a little, you know, just get a little smarter and everything's going to be okay.
Francis,
stay safe out there.
Can I get your social, Francis, please?
Oh, absolutely. My social security number. Sure. Let's just give that to everybody. It's already out there anyway. Let's see. It's 413-773-3333. Yeah, that's it.
All right. That might be the phone number. If you have any questions to get a hold of Francis, she will not give you her social for sure. You can also go to hugyourmoney.com and hopefully everybody goes there today. Thank you both. This was really interesting.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jess.
We'll be back next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rahm on WHMP.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rahm.
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rahm. Hi.
Hi, Jess. How are you?
I'm good. We had a couple little technical snafus, and I think we're better.
You know, we all have so much stuff in our lives. A lot of it is digital, You know, paring back is on a lot of people's minds, I think, and simplifying. And sometimes we're locked into it, like you and I are right now. We are, you know, in a digital world. But for a lot of people who are thinking about simplifying their lives, they might be thinking about downsizing their home. And that's what I wanted to talk about today.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about downsizing, it comes in many forms. Obviously, you could just buy a smaller house, right? Mm-hmm. You could move to a smaller apartment. You could move to an in-law apartment if you, you know, if you're...
I'm dreaming of a granny pod, I got to tell you.
The granny pod.
Have you heard of the granny pods?
I have. Why don't you tell people your idea of the granny pod, though? Why you like a granny pod?
I like it because I just feel like, you know, you'd be in somebody's backyard. So for me, it'd be like attached to somewhere where the kids were. They could come over. I could send them back to the main house. And then it's small, so it's easy to keep clean, and you don't have so much stuff in there. And I just think it would be cute as a button. But yes. I will say, I just for fun, like, look at prices, and they're still expensive. It's still expensive.
What prices are you seeing for those kinds of things?
I mean, $200, $250 for like a small little under 600 square foot little granny pod.
Okay, so that's much more than the research I did, which says you can build, say, a tiny home or a container home, anywhere. Now, this is a huge range, but anywhere between $20,000 and $150,000. And you're seeing prices even higher than that.
Well, because they don't include, when they're showing you that price, they're not including like the septic and the electric. And
that's
the,
right.
That costs a lot of money.
Yes. And that's, we were going to talk about that because, so the main idea behind this is just what you said. It would be cute as a button and it would be easy to keep. And okay. If you're downsizing, why am I talking about it, right? Why is the money doctor talking about this? Because if you're downsizing to save money, you need to pay attention to the details that you just brought up. And I knew you would because I knew you were doing the research on the granny pod. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Now, maybe the most expensive part of, let's focus on tiny homes for a moment. The most expensive part of a tiny home or a container home, we'll talk about each of those, is maybe getting the land. Your land may cost you more, right? So there are zoning bylaws that just say things like you can't just park your camper in the back of someone's house and live in it, right? There are zoning.
But a lot of the local towns have just approved the ADUs, so that's a good step in the right direction.
It's true. And even tiny homes, Massachusetts only approved tiny homes with, what was it called, Appendix Q in 2020, right? It's only 5 years ago. So this stuff's coming into its own now, and you can build one that is, if you have the skills, you can save yourself between 30 and 50% of the cost of the unit by building it as a DIY thing. And there are kits out there, right, that you can build.
They sell them on Amazon.
They do sell them on Amazon as well.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yes, you can find them all over the place. In fact, you can buy some of these homes used now. Now, the thing you need to remember when you're talking about that, okay, I'm going to get a kit. My friends are going to do the work for me or whatever. All right. You need to be realistic about this. What will it really cost you? And you need to check out your zoning laws in your area, because you will likely have to come up to code with things like electrical, plumbing, right? Maybe you can do this stuff on your own, but you may need a professional to do that. And they are not cheap. And they are not always readily available.
And not always getting stuff done on time either.
That's what was that? The movie, The Money Pit. How long was everything going to take?
Right.
2 weeks. Everything takes 2 weeks. Okay. So you know what happens. A lot of contractors start many jobs at once. They get the money in the door, and then lo and behold, they don't show up for a little while. Not all contractors, obviously. So you really have to be careful about this. So if you're looking to downsize in order to save money, you really need to do your research and see what the overall cost will be, like you've been doing with the land, the plumbing, the electrical, the wastewater, right? These are all things that might be that might have a higher cost for a tiny home or a container home than you might have in your regular home. You might need some special things like a water filtration system so that you can take rainwater and turn it into drinkable or potable water, right? Even your homeowner's insurance, you might need a specialized policy and it might be more expensive.
Right.
So you have to do your groundwork for this. Now, that being said, let's talk just a minute about tiny home versus container home.
Okay.
So a container home is built out of a metal container, right?
I know, like it's crazy.
Yeah, but they make
They make some of them really fancy and nice. Yeah.
they really do, and they can be welded, so they can stack one on top of another and things like that. So you can build quite a container home if your desire is that. But you will also have to be aware of probably different insulation. Metal cools quickly in our environment. In you can live in these year round, but in our environment in Massachusetts, we're going to care about insulation to keep us warm in the winter. In California or someplace that's much warmer, they might care about insulation to keep them cooler in the
Right.
summer, right? But
Yeah.
insulation is insulation, and you'll have to have a special kind for the metal units. If you go online and you look up tiny homes or container homes, you will find amazing pictures, absolutely amazing images. I
So
might put,
beautiful.
I know we're on radio, but we also put this out as a podcast. I might try to fit some of those into here. It's just astounding how creative people are with these
Oh,
things.
I'll send you some of my favorites because I look at this
Oh,
stuff all the time. Yeah.
I would love that. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Let's put some of
Okay.
yours in for sure. So, some of the things that you might end up spending money on that you maybe don't think of when you're just thinking, hey, I'm going to downsize. It's 50 grand for that house and I can put it on my lot and I'm good to go, right?
Right. Yeah.
You might have to think about things like, oh, I don't know, your furniture. Will your furniture fit in a tiny home? And it's likely that you will opt for multi-purpose furniture, things with
Right.
storage space inside of them, things that do double duty. In your kitchen, one of the suggestions I read about, I think it was Better Homes and Garden had a nice article about this too. And so did, I think it's tinyhomes.com.
Okay.
Tinyhomes.com like lists all the places, all the counties in Massachusetts that you can do these, and it points you to their bylaws. It's a great article.
Yeah.
But Better Homes and Gardens gave a lot of tips, and we'll go into some of those tips, I think, in the second half especially. But one of them was in your kitchen, maybe make use of things like floating shelves. Now, this stuff will appeal to people in any home. I walked into my own kitchen and was like, hey, could I put some floating shelves up and gain
Yeah.
my counter space?
The only thing, just have to remind people, you've got to keep it clean then.
Yeah, you have to keep it clean. So things like this will appeal to anybody. And in the kitchen, they were talking about maybe a rolling cart so that you don't clutter up your floor space in a tiny home or a container home on a permanent basis. And you pull it out when you need it. And when you don't, it goes, somewhere else and becomes something else, right?
Right.
So maybe it becomes your TV cart and then it's your kitchen cart or whatever. So you can get it to do double duty or a nightstand or whatever. So those kinds of things I think are really interesting and fascinating. And when you look at some of these images of tiny homes and container homes, you see these incredible loft spaces, because by definition, it in order to be approved, at least in our state, it has to have a living space, a cooking space like kitchen, and a bedroom, right? And a bath. It has to have those areas, and they all come. This stuff is so complicated if you start to look at it. So just when I say zoning bylaws, just you have to look at Massachusetts, and then you have to look at your town or city, because although Massachusetts has approved these homes, tiny home is under 400 feet, under 400 square feet, right? A tiny home is under 400 square feet. Your town or city also has its bylaws, and you will be expected to adhere
Follow
to them.
those.
Yeah, absolutely. And in some towns and cities, you can't get it approved without the building inspector, right? So this stuff's really got to pay, you've got to pay attention to it. But just to let people know, it is, as you said, really becoming more prevalent, right? And so, in that list of places in Massachusetts, for instance, counties, Franklin County, where I live, is one of them that's approved it through the Greenfield City Council. Berkshire County, north of us, approved. Hampshire County, you're in Hampshire or Hamden County? You're in
Hampshire.
Hampshire County. I believe it's approved there. But yeah, I'm sure that it is. Northampton, in particular, has approved those kinds of things. And even most of the counties now, but even Nantucket, if you're thinking, well, this is something for a rural area or, higher dollar places might not do it, even though we have plenty of high dollar area. Nantucket did it with a zoning bylaw 139, and they actually will approve under 500 feet. So it may
Got
be
it.
a tiny home in your mind, but not a tiny home to the state. May be acceptable by your town in certain districts. So you got to look at all this stuff. And there are fees involved with, inspections and permits and things like that.
I feel like other countries have known about this a lot longer than us because I always hear about,
you know, I watch House Hunters all the time, the casitas for the mother-in-laws. And I'm like, that's basically a little tiny house and I love it.
Yeah. They get these cute names like Tiny House and Casita and Granny Pod. And that's really appealing to people, I think. It is, I should say, a little different than your RV, right? Mm-hmm. These homes can be lived in year-round. They're designed.
And there are some tiny homes, though, that have wheels on them, so you can move them that way.
Yes, and you have to. So that's one of the considerations for a tiny home versus a container home, is that you might be looking for a mobile kind of a home, right? But you'll have to check with your town to find out, because a lot of the towns have said, yes, we'll approve these under 400 square foot homes if they're on a full foundation.
And that's more money.
Another cost. That's absolutely right.
There is all these hidden costs.
Yeah. So I think people get really excited initially about the idea of a tiny home, about decorating a tiny home. I have to tell you, I have a second property, and on that property, when I bought it, there was, and still is, a small space. It used to be an office, and it was nothing special, and we turned it into a little tiny home, right?
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
It has a composting toilet, which was approved, right? Mm-hmm. It has a self-contained sink. Mm-hmm. Now, I would say this unit is not, we don't rent it or anything like that. It's just those things are creature comforts when we're in that space, right?
Right.
And it's in addition to the primary home. But those, it's not really designed for long-term living, but it has a nice deck and a view of water and, you know, it's lovely. And every time somebody opens the door, myself included, I think I like it even better than the house, right? It's just
so
like,
cute, yeah.
I open the door, I'm like, oh my gosh, I just want to be in here, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to think about those kinds of things. And you could trim your costs by doing things like a compost toilet. And you can also keep your footprint small and they're ecologically friendly, all of that. But you have to remember that it has to be maintained all the time. These are things.
Well, this is my idea, Frances. And you tell me if this is a good idea or not.
Oh, boy.
I thought that I was going to save on land costs because I'm just going to get the tiny home, put it on the back of a truck to move it and just show up at my sister's. Have them unload it. And then I figure it'll be more work to get rid of me than to just let me stay.
What's your sister's number? Let's dial her up right now and ask her if it's a good idea.
But maybe get approval before you show up with a house.
But you bring up another point. Sometimes people want to use these for seasonal properties. Mm-hmm. And that has its own rules. Temporary tiny homes and temporary cottages like this have their own rules. So you have to check with your town about that. But in the end, I think when people are looking to save money on these things, there are a few different genres that it appeals to, right? Sectors that it appeals to. It appeals to somebody looking to downsize. Maybe mm-hmm. they're looking to sell their home, get the equity out of their home. Yeah, they're tired of going up and down stairs. They want to be closer to their kids. They can do it on a lot right next door or part of their lot or whatever. And that's an area of people, you know, a sector of people that like to do this. Another sector are people looking for second homes, like we just talked about. It's a temporary second home, and so it's less expensive. They don't have to worry about the major insulation if they're only going to be there seasonally and they're going to shut off all the water anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Their town might give them some breaks on things that they have to have for a seasonal property rather than a full-time property. And first-time home buyers, first-timers. Okay. You know, if we're talking about this, like, oh, it's under 400 square feet, like this is a major problem. There are a lot of people who live in apartments that are under 400 square feet.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's life, right? They don't have a basement. They don't have a lot of the things that other people have, an attic or things like that, but they make do with that just fine. So the main thing I'm going to tell you in this half before we go to break, I guess, is just if you're thinking about this, I want you to consider renting a tiny home for a few months.
They're hard to find though to rent, right? I mean, I always look online just to see, and they don't pop up that much. Used ones do, like for sale, like
that's
you're
right.
To buy,
but you might that much. Yeah, but you might be able to make a deal with somebody who has one for sale to give them a little income renting it for a few months with the option to buy it.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So we can talk about that when we come back.
All right. In the meantime, let's get your phone number.
Sure. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, and we're talking about, well, I call them granny pods, but I guess they could be tiny houses or container houses, ADUs.
That's right. And, you know, people other than grannies are buying them, right? And building them. And we were just talking about first-time home buyers, and I said, what I'd like people to do of all ages who are looking at this is to think about renting one for a period of a few months and trying this on. You know, what happens when you have 40 years of living in your home and all your, you know, your children's pictures and all your creature comforts, all your tchotchkes are all hanging out there. And you
is it
like
Marie Kondo? You got a Marie Kondo everything. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to get rid of stuff, especially when you have kids or it's just, like you said, that many years you collect stuff.
Yeah, Marie Kondo, actually, that's one of the things about decluttering. There are several ways to declutter. And her idea is you only keep things that talk to your heart, that speak to your heart, and you get rid of everything else.
Perfect. But I'm getting rid of all my bills.
Perfect. Digitize, right? No more paper storage. Yeah. So there are a lot of things like that. Another method is a four-box method. You know, I'm going to keep this. I'm going to donate that. This is going to get trash. That's going to go into storage, right? And you put everything in one of those four boxes, and then you sort it from there. So there are lots of tips about decluttering. But in talking about renting, you said, well, there aren't a lot available for rent. And while that's true, you could rent a space, you know, an apartment on a month-to-month lease that might be of a similar size. Just see how it feels to live in a space that size. Because, you know, especially if you have more than one person or you have a pet, you're going to want everybody to have their own personal space, even the pet, I guess, right? A space where the pet is comfortable and not on you all the time or whatever. So you need to think about that. But one creative thing that I can tell you that most people don't think of is to rent with an option. And what that means is you find somebody with one of these houses for sale that you think you might want to buy, and you have a conversation with them. Maybe you involve an attorney to help you through this or a coach. And you say, I think I might want to buy this. And it's the middle of winter. I know it's not flying off the market or whatever the situation is. It's been on the market for a long time and it hasn't sold yet. I would like to propose that I rent it from you for 3 months. That if and that I have the option at the end of 3 months to buy it for this dollar amount, and you agree on it right then and there, so nobody can change their minds and get harmed in this. And then at the end of 3 months, if you exercise your option, then whatever guidelines are in the option take place, like you're going to credit me 50% of my rent for the first 3 months toward the purchase price or whatever numbers you come up with. And if you don't take the option, they've gotten 3 months rent and it's back on the market for sale again.
Right? Yeah, that's a really good idea.
And you can, I mean, these contracts can be just about anything that two people can agree on. So that's a way to try it on. The ones that you see for sale, I will tell you, sure, you can get a house that's for sale, but guess why they're for sale and they're only a couple of years old? Because they weren't the right fit for the person. They couldn't, they didn't like it as much as they thought living in a granny pod, right?
So, yeah, and you're right. Like if you maybe rent something that same size, because the thought of it is great. But even for me, like, I'm like, oh, this would be great. But who knows? I might feel claustrophobic. I know for sure the lofts you were talking about, I would definitely want one with the height. So you could stand up. There's a lot of them that you have to kind of crawl up there. Well, and I think that would be, especially as you get older, that'd be hard.
Yeah, well, now that's an important point. And that's partly where the container homes, I think, are appealing to people because they can do it on one floor, you know, much longer, much larger space. There are zoning bylaws in your town or city that will tell you, for instance, the ceiling height in the overall habitational areas. What's the word I'm looking for? Whatever.
Living spaces.
The living spaces. The ceiling height in the living spaces has to be no less than 6'8". But in a loft, maybe it could be 6'2", you know, or 6'4". And so you have to look up your zoning bylaws to see what you have to do for that. Even things like stair treads and stair ceiling height as you're going up to that loft are governed. So you need to think about those kinds of things. We talked a little bit about land costs. That it's not too much to say here. Other than that, the mortgage for these homes is not typically a traditional mortgage. You might have to get a different kind of mortgage or personal loan. So you should think about that. But when it involves, and talk to your bank about it, when it involves a lot that you already own, a piece of land that you already own, you may be able to use that land in order to get a construction loan or something of that nature to make your tiny home dream come true, right?
So that's like collateral?
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, there's something called an improved lot, which is worth more than a plain piece of land. An improved lot usually has, you know, a septic or a connection to town water or sewer, something like that. But it might also have a foundation. If you're in a town where your tiny home has to be on a foundation, maybe you can afford to build the foundation and get your utilities connected, but you need a loan for the rest of the build. Well, you might be able to borrow against your improved lot in order to do that.
Okay.
So talk to a lender about this, a mortgage broker. If you need help with that, you can always call us. We're not a lender, but we'll refer you to places that we trust. We talked about your insurance being more. I do want to talk about some of the tips.
Okay.
So some of the tips that I thought were fun, and these will apply to all homes, not just tiny homes. And that's why I chose these particular ones. And these were from, I think, Better Homes and Gardens. Cleaning out your wardrobe. Oh, my goodness. Right. If you were going to move. Now, some people don't have a lot of clothes and some people have a ton of clothes and they switch them out from winter to spring to summer, seasonally, whatever. So this was a tip I loved. Turn your hangers in the opposite direction.
And when
when you get to the end of the season, the ones that are in the opposite direction, you haven't worn.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a clever tip?
That really is.
I thought that one was great. Install wall mounted storage. So this is not just floating shelves, but anywhere, bookshelves, anything that you can get off of your floor and onto the wall. If you think about this in terms of a tiny home, you'll even think about using ceiling space, right? Mm-hmm. And things like the space above your cabinets to put.
Yeah.
I remember my brother built a house in Florida. He built this big house. It was a beautiful big house, but he had a problem with large platters. He entertained a lot and he had these huge platters. And so when they built his kitchen cabinets in the kitchen, they made the ceiling a foot higher and above the kitchen cabinets was a rail and he put all his platters up there and they were all on display. He had to get a ladder to get to them, but they weren't shipped up and in a cabinet, you know. So think about using things like that or the insides of things, like even the insides of your cabinet doors. You have to be careful when you put things on there that when you close, it doesn't, you know, there is space to do that. It doesn't hit a shelf or something. But you can do a lot with decluttering, you know, your house by using things like that.
And the tiny houses do show you good tips, too. Like I always see hidden storage in the stairs.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
In the stairs, in the floor sometimes, in the ceiling sometimes, right? Under the loft. You know, things that do double duty, like the refrigerator is built in, but where it's built in, there's a thing above it that happens to be the television, right? Mm-hmm. Which you wouldn't maybe do in a typical home, but in a tiny home, that's your living space. You're going to get up and cook something. You're going to pull the refrigerator open. You're going to sit down. You're going to eat it and watch it on TV, right? All in that one area.
All in one.
Think about things like your furniture. We talked about multi-purpose furniture.
Yeah. But
when you're thinking about a tiny home or a container home, you also want to start thinking about slimmer furniture. In other words, think about what's important to you. The place that you sit is important to you, but do you really need big, bulky arms on your chair? You know, we have this whole phase where everybody went to overstuffed furniture, oversized furniture. That is not going to work in a tiny home. You got to find slim stuff. Think more modern, more sleek, less space taking. So think about things like that. One of the things about tiny homes that we used in this other property I was talking about as well is mirrors and shiny objects. So I'm not talking about like aluminum foil everywhere, right? But you can take, you can hang a mirror anywhere and it will help you
bring more light in.
Yeah, it looks like more space. It brings light in. But you can even just lean one against a wall, you know, on top of a bureau or something like that, a big mirror, make a statement with it. But also shiny surfaces. Like if you think about a glass coffee table instead of a hardwood coffee table, that allows you... It looks like the objects are floating. It allows you to see the carpet underneath it or the floor underneath it. It's less noticeable as a big clunky object.
It right.
feels like it opens a space. Or anything that is reflective, you know, silver appliances or anything that's reflective will help bring the light in and will help to make the space feel a little more open. But decluttering is the absolute number one thing. So,
yeah.
I mean, this is just a fun topic. And I hope that if there are people listening to this that are considering it, that what they heard me say is watch your dollars,
mm-hmm.
research, right?
Go ahead.
No, you.
The other good thing that I forgot to mention earlier that it's really good for is there's a lot of people that have parents now that don't want to give up their home, but they don't want to go into an assisted living facility, but they need help. You've got this in your backyard. They still have their independence, but you've got somebody right there. And it just seems like the best of both worlds. They don't feel like they're living with you or you've got to deal with like the son-in-law or daughter-in-law and whatever, the noise with the kids, but somebody's there if they need something.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know how the trend started, but in Northampton, Mass, you have a wonderful facility that is an assisted living facility, and they have independent living cottages. They get the socialization if they want to go to the main building and mm-hmm. attend classes or bingo or music or whatever. And they also have help if they need it.
They're wonderful, but they can get super expensive.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about what those cost per month, how many months you're going to pay for that, that's, I think, where people are starting to say, but I could own this. And again, you know, it's not just for people downsizing. First-time homebuyers, people who mm-hmm. are looking to keep a small footprint and live a simple lifestyle, people who don't have a lot of clutter to begin with are like, boy, I could live in a tiny home. It's my own
yeah.
space. I don't have a landlord. I could do that, you know.
I've seen people, too, on some of those shows that I watch all the time where they put that in the back. They moved into that and rented out the big house, got their mortgage paid for way quicker than they would have.
You brought up a very important point when you said rent. A lot of towns will allow these tiny homes, but they have to be occupied by the owner and not mm-hmm. rented out. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, well, I'll just build a bunch of those and rent them out, you
right.
better check with your town first.
Yeah.
However, something like we were talking about where you're renting to own, mm-hmm. you could check with the town, but that is probably going to be allowed if you're doing it as part of a real estate contract.
Right. It's not like an Airbnb kind of thing.
Yeah. It's
yeah.
different than that. Yeah. Yeah. So,
well, this was so fun. I have been looking at these and I will send you some pictures because I have some that are just beautiful,
yeah.
which, you know, are not under 100,000. But yeah, I'd love to share the pictures.
I just love the ideas. It doesn't matter what the cost of the home is that you're looking
yeah.
at. There are so many creative ideas, and a lot of them are really about saving money as well as space.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
so I hope this was a useful and fun show for people.
Yeah, super fun. Let's get your phone number.
Sure. It's 413-773-3333.
And you can also visit hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rand. Thank you.
Thanks, Jess.